полёша рыжий, было парень умный и могучий. В обращении был со всеми милый, но язык был враг его трясой.
Das war ein Auszug aus Alesha von Peter Leschenko. Und jetzt könntet ihr sagen, ach Lele, das ist doch einfach nur eine Aufnahme von irgendeiner Platte. Ist halt ewig alt, klingt auch irgendwie nicht so spitze. Und ich würde sagen, ja, doch, das stimmt. Aber dann würde ich sagen, das ist eine Aufnahme von einer Platte, auf der Knochen zu sehen sind. Das muss Mensch sich erst einmal auf der Zunge zergehen lassen. Das hier ist Kulturgut, der Podcast von Dussmann, das Kulturkaufhaus, und mein Name ist Lele Lukas. Das Thema heute heißt Bone Music. Halt, stopp. Nicht diese Art von Bone Music. Knochenmusik. Musik auf Röntgenbildern. Vom 14.08. bis zum 5.09. ist die Ausstellung Bone Music in der Villa Heike in Berlin zu Gast und ich habe mit Stephen Coates gesprochen. Dem haben wir das Ganze zu verdanken. Und übrigens, am 10.08. gibt es im Kulturkaufhaus einen Vortrag und ein kleines Live-Konzert. Hier könnt ihr live miterleben, wie dieses Konzert in ein Röntgenbild geschnitten wird. Aber dazu später mehr. Jetzt finden wir erstmal heraus, was es mit diesen Schallplatten auf Bildern von Knochen auf sich hat. Achtung, das Interview ist auf Englisch.
Расскажу я вам этот случай осенней порой, шел он с парочкой, шел он с дамочкой, был одет и прекрасный бежой.
Well, hello, I'm Stephen Coates, and for the purposes of this, I'm a musician and a broadcaster, and of course a curator. I'm the curator of the X-ray audio project and the Bone Music Berlin exhibition.
You are dealing with music cut into X-rays. Is that correct?
Yes. Dealing is an interesting word. I wouldn't use the word dealing, although, and of course, in a way, it is a good word to use, because this is a project which is about people who bootlegged music. And of course, they did deal it. It's a project about this in the Soviet Union in the 1940s through to the early 60s, how an underground community of music lovers and bootleggers, right? They were both music lovers and, as we would say, entrepreneurs. They had a culture of making their own recordings onto X-ray film, which of course is a very odd idea. And the reason that they did that was the music that they were making these records from was forbidden music, forbidden in the Soviet Union for various ideological reasons. And the reason that they were using X-ray film is that, of course, the normal means of production of making vinyl records was beyond them. It was not possible to do that secretly. So they devised this very ingenious method of using special machines, which, by the way, were based on German machines. And they were using as a medium X-ray film, which of course is a German invention, to make their own very strange special records. We call it bone music.
Okay, so let me get this straight. Someone had an X-ray done and then took their X-ray somewhere and they cut a circle. And I read somewhere someone used cigarette butts to put the hole in the middle. And then they put it on a machine. They play live music and that live music would be cut into the circle. Is that somewhat correct, or where am I?
It is somewhat correct, but it's also somewhat incorrect in the sense that it wouldn't be specific x-rays. It wouldn't be, say you've broken your leg, right, and you went to the hospital in the old days and they made an x-ray on film as they used to do in the pre-digital age. It wouldn't be that, like, then you would take that x-ray and then cut some music onto it. It was a bit more random. So in Soviet Union, obviously, particularly in the 1940s and 50s, there were millions of x-rays being made because they were testing people for tuberculosis, actually. So you get a lot of chest x-rays being done. So you get a huge amount of these x-rays. And of course, they had to get rid of them, the hospitals, because in those days, x-ray film was flammable. It could catch fire. So they had to get rid of it. And these bootleggers had found that it was suitable for their illicit purposes. So they would go to the hospitals after hours in the dark and make deals with the technicians from the hospital. And they would take that away. And then, as you say, they would, yes, cut it into circles quite crudely with scissors or a knife. And there is this story that they used the hot cigarette butt cut to make the hole in the middle. I'm not totally convinced about that. The reason is that x-ray film, as I said, could catch fire.
So okay, yeah.
I don't think it's a good idea. I personally wouldn't do it. And if you were making a lot of x-rays, that's a lot of cigarettes. That's a lot of risk of, like, you know, setting yourself on fire. But it's a very nice myth, and it may be people occasionally did that, yeah. So they would do that, and then you've got a blank recording, and they would fit it onto this special machine called a recording lathe, and that would write the music or the sound into the surface of disc, yeah.
And then they'd have someone play it and have a microphone in front of them, or would they basically do what people did with tapes not that long ago, when one tape just went on to the other tape?
Both those things, actually. And yeah, you mentioned that earlier. So how would they, what was the sound source? Well, the sound source was, it came from gramophone records. So they'd copy other gramophone records. They would also copy the signal from the radio, particularly radio, which was being broadcast from the West, you know, jazz, rock and roll, etc. And then also they would also record live. And you know, that's obviously what we're going to do next week at Dustman. You can, any audio signal, you know, from a radio, from a gramophone, or from a live mix can be used to make the recording.
You did a TED talk about this, and you said that you found one in basically at a stall in a flea market. What was that like putting, did you ever listen to that specific one? What was it like putting that on and, like, having all of that stuff basically open up?
Well, I can be honest with you. It was very, very extraordinary experience for me, because I bought the record in this flea market, as you say, in St. Petersburg, which was, of course, was Leningrad, which is kind of where this whole thing really started. And 70 years ago. And, you know, when I brought it, I knew it was a record for sure, because it looked like a record, but also it looked like an x-ray. And my Russian friends didn't know what it was. So when I brought it back to London and I tried to play it, first things, it's 78 RPM. So, you know, it's kind of probably from the 40s or 50s, right, or earlier. And then single-sided, so only music on one side. That's quite unusual. And then, of course, when I dropped the needle on it, started to play, it was Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley, which means that it's after 57, right? We know that, okay? So, yeah, my response to it was, well, I don't want to swear, but what the is this? Because, you know, who made it? Why did they make it? And how did they make it? And really, those three questions is what this whole project, which happened, you know, over the next few years, was about, trying to answer those questions.
And then you packed your things, went to St. Petersburg and followed the trail of x-rays? Or what was the road from that moment to now, when we're talking and you have the exhibition next week, and also there is a book coming out, and there was a movie, and so on and so forth?
Right. So what happened was is that I was very, very interested to find out, you know, as I said, the answer to those questions. So whenever I went back to Russia, to perform. I'm a musician. I used to play in Russia a lot. And so I'd go back and ask people, we'd try and find out more. As I said, many people didn't seem to really know much about it. Older people had heard of these records. And then I was fortunate enough to be introduced to somebody who did know about them. And he introduced me, Maxim Kravchinsky. He's an academic, actually. And he introduced me to a guy in St. Petersburg who used to be a bootlegger, who used to make these records when he was young, and Rudolf Fuchs. And he, Rudy, was our window, really, or the doorway into that world, because he started to tell us how it worked and, you know, how they did it, and tell us about the culture of this. So what we did is that, and then we met other people. So we started to record interviews with them. And every time I went back to Russia, I would try and meet more people and record more interviews and to build up this story, you know. And then originally what happened was is that I gave the TED talk, which you mentioned, and started to write about it. We had a very small exhibition in London because I started to collect these, find more of these records, then I knew more about them so I could talk about them. But a really small exhibition, and it just... it got a very, very positive response from people. Like people like me, like you, you know, were fascinated by the story. And I think that was very encouraging. So we just kept going. I kept with Paul Hartfield, my collaborator, who's a photographer. So we started to kind of research more deeply. And the project grew into, as you said, a documentary film and a BBC documentary and the exhibition, which has been traveling. And live events. So, you know, it just kept going. And I think it kept going because it's a very, very strange, interesting story. And for all of us who are music fans, I mean, I'm a musician, but, you know, I'm also, of course, a music fan. It's a story about how much music matters, right? And so I think that for all of us, that is a story that we want to hear being told. And I think that's why we've, you know, been able to keep doing it.
I think I read somewhere that you can't really, they're not forever things. Like you can't play them 100 times like any old vinyl or anything like that. They degrade in some way.
When they were made, of course, the technology and the means of making them was quite, as we would say, lo-fi, right? Low fidelity. You know, it was bootleg technology, right? So the quality was often very poor, sound quality. But also they were made to be played and thrown away. They were disposable. They were cheap to buy. I call them street trash, you know. They were like something punk, you know, there's something like punk about them. They were made by young people, for young people, really. And the idea, you know, you would play it until it was destroyed, maybe at the beginning, 10, 15 plays, that was it. That was because at the beginning, people were still using, you know, wind-up old-fashioned gramophones with steel needles. You know, that would tear these records apart after 10 plays, right? With electric record, vinyl record players, you can play them, you know, maybe 25, 30 times, but they'll start to deteriorate for sure. So the fact that they sounded like shit and didn't last didn't matter, you know. And you would play it, you would throw it away, and you'd buy another one.
Huh. So it was more of the chance to hear that specific music than to, like, nowadays, or when you have something that you put on your record player, people, it's kind of turned around. Like, people maybe buy vinyl to have the vinyl, not as much to listen to it that much. And then it was more of a, I can actually listen to this now that I can never, that I can't hear anywhere else. Would that be correct?
That's a great point, actually. That's a really good point, because of course now, right now in 2021, vinyl is like a precious thing. You know, music fans, all of us, you know, we might buy vinyl by an artist, and then we might just put the vinyl on the shelf, right, and then listen to it on Spotify, okay? You're absolutely right. This is completely the opposite, which is that the object itself was disposable. What was important was what was on it. And, of course, what was on it was the music that people wanted to listen to, not the music that they were supposed to listen to, okay? So the music that people loved, You know, so particularly young people, forbidden music, music that was from the West that was forbidden, but also a lot of Russian music that was forbidden for all sorts of insane, crazy reasons. So, you know, that's what made it precious, not the object, but the content.
Then do I imagine just, I mean, you've met people who dealt in that, and do I imagine just people sitting in their living rooms, having the windows closed and shut off so that nobody hears it, and then they just hear it for themselves and have that moment? Or do I imagine them bringing together large groups of people to enjoy that together, kind of like a, I don't know, I know the analogy is kind of not, but like a illegal rave kind of type deal? How do I imagine that?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So I think actually both those things, these records existed at a very strange time, because of course they first started to make them in the late 1940s. And from the late 1940s till about 1953 was some of the worst times in the Soviet Union. They call it the Great Terror, you know. So listening to forbidden music then would have to be something very secret, actually. You'd have to probably, I mean, and I've talked to people who said that they used to play them very, very quietly at home, as you say, right? Maybe with their friends, but, you know, be secretive. After Stalin died in 1953 and Khrushchev came to power, particularly towards the end of the 1950s and early 1960s, things got a lot easier. And so somebody else that we talked to told us how, you know, he would balance his portable record player on the window of his parents' apartment, and he would blast these rock and roll records into the courtyard, you know. And of course all the kids would be like, this is great. And all the adults would be like, turn that fucking noise off. You know, it would be regarded as being antisocial, right? Like you mentioned raves, rather than, you know, politically dangerous. Right? Whereas in 1946, of course, 1947, it was, you know, playing Western music, you know, could get you in bad trouble. So, yeah.
Did all of this change your outlook on music as a musician yourself?
Absolutely did, yeah, because we live in an amazing time, right? I mean, you know, where we can access anything almost immediately and almost for free. You know, music is really free. You know, we don't really have to pay very much, if anything, and we can get it all, right? This is a story about a very different time, you know, when music was not free and one song could be very, very precious. One song could be very, very valuable to the person that played it, because it was difficult to find, it was difficult to buy, maybe it didn't sound very good. So the value of a particular song, even a song like Rock Around the Clock, which is a bit dumb, right? I mean, it's not the kind of world's best poetry, is it? You know, and it's not particularly anti-communist or anything. It's just saying, look, forget everything else, forget work, let's just party, right? It's not, you know, it's not Solzhenitsyn, right? You know, even a song like that could be very precious to people, because it's particularly a young Soviet person at that time, because maybe it had an energy, it had a sense of freedom about it. And so for me, as a personally, it's just really valuable to recollect that music was not always this way. It was not always completely free, completely abundant. And I think there is a question to ask for all of us, which is that, you know, have we lost something at the same time as gaining something? Have we lost that sense of the preciousness of one particular song? In exchange for the abundance of the entire history of recorded music at the click of a mouse? It's just a question. I don't know the answer. I'm just
But I mean, yeah, I was just thinking that too, that there is like it has a certain weight and an importance in the old kind of sense, and now it's just another song. But do you like, I don't know, assuming that you as a musician maybe also make your money from your music, and you could argue that all the abundance isn't that we don't value the music, certainly not as much as back then, but in general, oftentimes music isn't valued that much anymore. Would that be correct? And is there, if you could steal a part from back then and take it into the now from the way people think about it, would you do that? Or do you think it's good the way it is?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think it's better now. To be honest, it's a lot better now. And I think that question that I asked about have we lost something whilst we've gained something, I think the gains are huge, right? If you're a musician, the gains are less, I think, because of course, the streaming models, which is amazing for a music fan, and I'm a music fan, so, you know, it's amazing for all of us. But, you know, for a musician, it's pretty catastrophic, as a kind of financial model, right? My feeling, interestingly, is that music is going full circle. It's going back to the way it was. I mean, really, you didn't have, before the early parts of the 20th century, you didn't have musical stars. You didn't really have musical individuals. Music was a kind of cultural thing which was shared across the culture. That, you know, there were musicians, maybe weren't particularly highly regarded. You know, they were just part of the general culture. I think it's going back to that. And I think it's that people are going to carry on producing music. Amazing music is being made all the time, and it's much easier to make it. It's much easier to release it and to share it. But I think as a kind of an economic model for musicians, I think we've gone over the hill and we're heading down. And that's okay. That's just because that was just the way it was. We had, maybe there's a golden age at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, and that golden age is passing. I'm talking about economically, not in terms of the quality of music. I can't speak I think there's great stuff being made, really do, amazing stuff being made.
So when people go to the exhibition or to the live events, what can they expect? What happens there? What is it? Just let me be mean for a second. Is it just a bunch of x-rays hanging on the wall and that's that? Or
yeah, that's it, pretty much. in a way, yes, that is what it is, actually. But there are a bunch of x-rays hanging on a wall, but they are rather beautiful things, right? They are mysterious things. But the exhibition really is intended to answer those questions, you know, who made these records? Why did they make them? And how did they make them? And really, that's what it's about. So it's like going inside a story. Going into a world, and that evokes this particular time, and I think people will love it because there is something unique and magical about it, actually, about these things. In terms of live events, what we do is I tell the story in more detail about the Soviet bootleggers and this culture, and you know the risks that they took to do this. The risks were high, the rewards were low. And what we do is a demonstration of how to cut music onto x-ray film. We've got a 1940s machine, and we'll use that and some x-rays to record a live performance. And Tuesday at this moment, we're going to record Martin from the Tiger Lilies, who's a old friend of mine and a terrific performer, amazing. And he's also a resident half of the year in Berlin. I'm sure Berliners know the Tiger Lilies. So we're going to record him onto an x-ray, and then we're going to play it back. Well, I mean, I say that we're going to try to do that. It's an unpredictable business. It's like, I always say, it's like cooking with a blindfold on. So you never know what it's going to taste like. Yeah, that's the exhibition, that's the live event, yeah.
And then that record will go into your private collection, and you'll rub your hands because you have another one-of-a-kind x-ray record?
Thanks for reminding me. Of course, missed that. The most important thing, of course, right, which is that at Dussmann on Tuesday, we are going to auction this record on behalf of Free Muse. And for listeners or people who don't know who Free Muse are, because the best way to think of them is maybe like Amnesty International for artists and musicians. They are a group that represent and publicized the plight and the troubles of musicians and artists who are being repressed in various places in the world. This story is about censorship in music and repression in music. And sadly, of course, that is not an historical fact that's going on now. So Free Muse will be there. They will also talk about their work. And as part of the event, that we will auction the record that we make from Martin's performance on behalf of Free Muse. Yeah.
Wenn er nicht gerade Platten auf Röntgenbildern hinterherjagt, dann verlegt Stephen Coates auch andere Musik. Unter anderem die Musik vom russischen Komponisten Mikhail Tariverdiev. Einen Link dazu gibt's in den Shownotes. Die gibt's entweder in eurem Podcatcher oder unter kulturgut.podigy.io. In den Shownotes findet ihr auch alle weiteren Infos zur Veranstaltung am 10.8. im Kulturkaufhaus und zur Ausstellung in der Villa Heike in Berlin. Es gibt auch einen Link zu mehr Aufnahmen von den besonderen Platten. Aus der Vergangenheit springen wir ins Jetzt, in die Zeit, wo alle Musik immer zur Verfügung steht. Ich habe mir Linde aus der Musikabteilung geschnappt und mir zwei Platten empfehlen lassen. Den Anfang macht das heiß erwartete neue Album von Billie Eilish.
Ich glaube, die erste Single ist letztes Jahr im November erschienen und die war sehr, sehr ähnlich von der Musik her wie auch ihr Vorgängeralbum. Oder ihr erstes Album allgemein. Die darauf folgenden Singles, da hat man schon gemerkt, dass es irgendwie ein bisschen weitergegangen ist mit ihr, dass sie irgendwie jetzt über andere Sachen redet, dass sie auch anders über Themen spricht, viel offener und kritischer, trotzdem aber auch sehr, sehr künstlerisch und lyrisch. Also ihr Songwriting hat sich auf jeden Fall verändert. Es ist ja immer schwer, das einzuordnen und zu sagen, das ist jetzt gut, weil und das ist jetzt schlecht, weil. Aber irgendwie ist es ein bisschen cooler einfach noch. Und die Musik ist ein bisschen diverser geworden einfach. Also irgendwie hat sie jetzt viel mehr Stile drin. Früher war das ja sehr, sehr bass-elektro-lastig und hier und da auch mal so ein paar Hip-Hop-Einflüsse, aber schon sehr düster insgesamt. Mittlerweile ist es halt auch irgendwie, da sind irgendwie Soul-Tracks dabei, da sind richtige Trap-Songs dabei oder auch Lieder, bei denen man denkt, okay, hat sie sich jetzt eine Band dazu genommen, aber sie hat ja mit Phineas alles am Computer gemacht. aber halt viel musikalisch diverser, ja.
Okay. Ich weiß noch, letzten Samstag haben wir uns abgesprochen und da lief es unten.
Genau.
Hast du es dann einfach durchlaufen lassen? Also ist es so ein gutes Album zum Hören oder ist es so eins, ja okay, ich habe es jetzt einmal gehört, dann packe ich es wieder zur Seite.
Also ich höre das ziemlich häufig tatsächlich. Wenn man es einmal von vorne bis hinten durchhört, ich glaube, ich hat 16 Lieder, geht ungefähr eine Stunde, was heute auch schon die Ausnahme ist. Das kann man gut durchhören und im Gesamteindruck ist es trotzdem ruhig. Also es gibt viele Power-Songs, die irgendwie einen Beat haben und zu denen man richtig mitgehen kann. Insgesamt ist es aber trotzdem, dominieren die ruhigeren Songs und die sind teilweise auch sehr, sehr schmerzlich. Ich kann sowas meistens nur zu bestimmten Anlässen hören, in bestimmten Gefühlslagen. Aber dadurch, dass die Songs so unterschiedlich sind, ist es eine gute Mischung. Also ich höre das total gerne. Es ist nicht zu experimentell, es ist trotzdem noch Pop und eingängig und ja. I didn't change my number. I only changed who I replied to. Laura said I should be nicer. But not to you. I love her, you were mad at me too. Should've guessed that you would think I was upset. You're obsessed. Don't take it out on me. I'm out of sympathy for you. Maybe you should leave before I get to me. I didn't change my number.
Neben Billie Eilish hat mir Linde noch von Jeremias erzählt. Oder Jeremias, da waren wir uns nicht ganz sicher.
Das ist halt eine der neuen deutschen Jungsbands im Indie-Sektor. So, als ich das Cover gesehen habe, dachte ich, okay, das nächste Provinz-Album, die ich gar nicht mag, muss ich sagen. Also
Provinz ist eine Band?
Ja, genau. Okay. Provinz ist eine Band, die hat, glaube ich, letztes Jahr im Herbst haben die ihr Debütalbum rausgebracht, was auch total krass erwartet war, so von wegen so, ja, an mein Kantereit nur vom Bauernhof so mäßig. Also halt vom Dorf und irgendwie ein bisschen derber und nicht so künstlerisch, dafür halt mehr so, ja, wir trinken und rauchen und wir sind hier zu Hause und so. Ja, ein bisschen weirde Beschreibung. Genau, und dann dachte ich so, oh, ja, schon wieder sowas, weil ich feiere die gar nicht, obwohl ich selber vom Dorf komme und eigentlich alles unterschreiben kann, aber die sind mir viel zu aufgesetzt, wie dem auch sei. Dann habe ich das angehört und dachte so, hä? Das sind nicht irgendwie die nächsten Provinz, sondern das sind eher die nächsten Parcels. Das war übelst cool, weil die einfach super funkige Musik machen. Die sind zu viert und auf dem Cover sehen die aus wie 17 und legen da irgendwie Lieder hin, die man irgendwie, keine Ahnung, von der 20 Jahre bestehenden Funkband erwarten würde. So. Und die Texte sind halt eher ein bisschen witziger und ein bisschen fragmentarischer und nicht so krasses Storytelling, sondern eher so, ja, irgendwie, wir machen Musik und irgendjemand muss Texte schreiben, deswegen singen wir einfach das ein, was uns gerade einfällt. So. Das finde ich ein bisschen charmanter. Und der Frontsänger, der hat doch eine sehr coole Stimme einfach und das war total das Überraschungsding für mich, weil ich die auch nicht irgendwie nirgends in Medien oder so mitbekommen hätte, dass es die jetzt gibt und dass die ein Album rausbringen. Das stand auf einmal irgendwie im Regal und dann war das gleich so ein Glücksgriff. Und die spielen jetzt auch im September, spielen die auf der Trabrennbahn oder nee, auf der Rennbahn in Tempelhof. Und da gehe ich auch hin. Da bin ich total gespannt, wie die so live sind. Aber ja, voll cool. Ich weiß noch nicht, wer sie kommen. Aber halt eher von wegen Lisbeth als an mein Kantereit. Okay. So von der Einordnung her.
This must be the place, steht an meiner Wand. Ich mag das hier so sehr, hab trotzdem bisschen Angst. Bin auf der Flucht und ich weiß noch nicht vor was. Vielleicht davor, dass ich etwas.
Da haben wir's. Das war die 62. Folge von Kulturgut, dem Podcast von Dussmann, das Kulturkaufhaus. Vielen, vielen, vielen Dank an Stephen Coates für das Interview und Linde für die Empfehlung. Hendrik hat den Wortwitz verteidigt. Mein Name ist Lele Lukas und wenn euch das hier gefallen hat, dann lasst uns 5 Sterne bei Apple Podcasts da, empfehlt den Podcast weiter. Kommt am 10.8. ins Kulturkaufhaus und zwischen dem 14.8. und dem 5.9. in die Villa Heike oder schreibt eine E-Mail an kulturgut@dussmann.de und sagt mir, was euch gefallen hat oder was euch nicht gefallen hat. Shownotes gibt's wie immer unter kulturgut@podigy.io und alles Gute, bis zum nächsten Mal.